BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on. You can count
on. I suppose you're wondering what you're doing here.
It had crossed my mind. What's it all about?
Sit down and I'll tell you. It's a question of your resignation.
Go on.
The information in your head is priceless. I don't think you realize what a valuable property you've become. A man like you is worth a great deal on the open market.
Who brought me here?
I know how you feel, believe me. And they have taken quite a liberty.
Who are they?
A lot of people are curious about what lies behind your resignation. You had a brilliant career. Your record is impeccable. They want to know why you suddenly left.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Daily Express floating the theory. The Twin Towers were brought down by bombs on 9/11. Also, we cross the channel to Rotterdam to hear concern about the Bilderbergers and the Bilderberg conferences from there. And also the Rolodex scandal, a paedophile scandal re-emerging over in Holland. Also, we speak to a former Russian aerospace engineer about the Russian view of the Bilderbergers. And the Western Alliance, NATO particularly, is Vladimir Putin just another gangster? Unser Politics Blog is a blog site over in Germany, based in Wuppertal. We'll be hearing from them all about EU plans, secret ones, to privatise police, civil service and armies right across the European Union, but not in Germany. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But we begin this week with a headline in the Daily Express. Were 9/11 towers blown up by bombs this week? University probes if planes were really responsible. It's one of the world's biggest conspiracy theories. They love to use that word, don't they? Which was invented by the CIA after the death of John F. Kennedy, when people started getting close to realising who was really behind it. That the West was involved in plotting, organising and even carrying out the 9/11 terror atrocities to provide the grounds for the military strikes on the so-called Axis of Evil. And this came out on Wednesday in the Daily Express, and I'm joined by author and 9/11 truther, Ian Henschel. Hi, Ian.
Hi, hi.
And welcome to the Politics Show. Just tell us about your book.
Well, I brought out my book 10 years ago now, over 10 years ago, 9/11, The New Evidence. It was published by a mainstream publisher. It was serialised in the Daily Mail, but we just hit a brick wall. We could not get onto TV. Sky News said that we were too friendly with the anti-Tony Blair campaign, but for some reason they wouldn't let us on. But it was a bestseller, and we basically asked a lot of questions. I'm a 9/11 truther in the sense that I want to know the truth about 9/11. You know, not that I particularly think I've got a theory which is true about 9/11, but what is certainly the case with the 9/11 attacks, they have never been explained. There's a million holes in the official story, and it's just a huge scandal.
I mean, it seems to me the media has been a massive part of this, Ian, over the years.
And entirely.
You're telling me that you hit brick wall when it came to trying to get a little bit of publicity for your book.
Yeah,
for example.
I mean, the average sensational political non-fiction book, which is serialised in the Daily Mail, which is becomes a non-fiction bestseller, automatically gets into the mainstream, you know, broadcast media. Not me, not my book. You know, I would infer that they don't want to know. And of course, Jimmy Savile, we've in the meanwhile, since 9/11, we've had the Jimmy Savile scandal, where now they're admitting that some things are too big for them to tell us the truth about. They knew about Jimmy Savile in just the same way that they know about 9/11.
We were hearing last week about the Iran-Contra scandal and how in the United States there was just a refusal for any of the newspapers to print it, even though editors and managers and journalists all knew it was going on.
Yeah, no, this is the same again and again and again. And it's, you know, it's a bit like Eastern Europe under communism, where, you know, the party line, if you don't agree with the party line, you're an enemy of the people, or, as they say here, a conspiracy theorist. We had a special State Department page on their website denouncing our book, and everybody said, everybody who should have known, who were in the media, they said, this is your great chance, Ian, now the media will have to cover it. No, they didn't. They followed the line of the State Department, and, you know, we were just pronounced as persona non grata.
Well, I mean, often the media do miss stuff. So did you actually ever tackle journalists with your book
endlessly,
and go shove the book under their nose and say, and who did you tackle?
Oh, I spoke to any number of them. I'm getting a bit rusty on names at my age, Tony, but the guy who does Channel 4 News, you know.
Jon Snow,
he said he'd look at my book, never got back to me. The Guardian, I spent a lot of time talking to the independent comment pages, and when they finally moved an inch in my direction, the guy, you could hear the fear in his voice when he phoned up to say he was going to give a little bit of space to an American politician called Cynthia McKinney. You could hear the fear in his voice, you know. And I mean, there's a BBC a Middle East correspondent who reckons he can only tell the truth twice a year or he'll lose his job. You know, you don't have to know them that well before they start, you start getting the true picture.
Martin, I know you're also part of this sort of 9/11 Truth network that sprung up after September the 11th attacks in the mid-noughties. And what do you put this reluctance of the London media to cover this properly? What do you put it down to?
Well, look, the people who did 9/11, let's just do a thought experiment. If you do something like that, you're not just doing it, you're also, the main purpose of it is to use the media to bamboozle people into doing what you want, and the media are there to do that. They are either basically corporate media, which depend on advertising, or, you know, and we all know who the big players are, people like Murdoch, Berezovsky in Russia and so on, or they are government-run, and therefore, to some extent, under the control of the government.
Voluntary and funded by rich foundations, which turn out to have the same
the corporate level. But what's allowed the 9/11 truth movement, if we can call it that, to function is the internet and alternative media. So, and that includes talk radio like this, but it also includes YouTube, etc. And that does an end run around this. And of course, Russia Today and Press TV have also been prepared to ask questions about these events in English for an English language audience around the world. It's a fact that Ivashov, who is the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, has already made his position clear on this. You'd have thought Radio 4 listeners ought to have been informed of that, that the former head of the Russian armed forces thinks it was an inside job. They know nothing because they're told.
The Daily Express has finally got round to it after all this time, whatever it is, 14 years, and they're saying the Twin Towers were hit by planes, but conspiracy theorists, in inverted commas, claim bombs brought them down. While many of the theories are bizarre, one long-standing view is that the towers would not have collapsed in the way they did if they were hit by aircraft. Some claim there must have been a controlled demolition at ground level for the Twin Towers to fall in on themselves as they did. One key part of the argument is the collapse of a third smaller tower called Building 7 at the World Trade Center several hours after the huge skyscrapers fell. Until now, the theory had been just that had been confined to the online forums of conspiracy theory websites, but now the University of Alaska sponsoring a full investigation into claims World Trade Center Building 7 was brought down by controlled demolition during the attacks, Ian.
Yeah, well, as you say, this has been going on for a long time. I think what people might not realise is that there has never been a transparent investigation into really any aspects of the 9/11 attacks. That, you know, you'll be told by the establishment, oh, we've looked into this. Well, they might have looked into it, but they haven't shared their findings with us. You know, the computer models they used are still secret. The data they fed into them are largely secret. The conclusions and the logic is, you know, partly public and partly secret. So basically, we've been at war for 15 years now based on a story which nobody has given any hard evidence is true. And of course, the other side of this is, let's not forget the paper trail, which is equally damning to the establishment. And it's likely, due to this latest sort of friction with Saudi Arabia, this has all come into the open now. That's, you know, if anybody was behind the 9/11 attacks, it looks like the Saudis, although actually it would have been a network, you know, of people, and they'd have made sure they had a Saudi supporter and a Pakistani and the CIA and so on.
The Americans totally closed US airspace after 9/11.
But the only people let out.
They allowed one aircraft to leave the US, and that was full of Saudis.
That's right. That's a slightly, you know, exaggerated, but that is basically the case. And now we know that the Saudi ambassador was funding, he says he doesn't know about it, but was funding the 9/11 hijackers, several of the alleged 9/11 hijackers.
So who was on this one plane then that was allowed out through American airspace? Because that, to me, seems like a bit of a smoking gun. If you're trying to close the airspace and yet you're allowing a plane with Saudi nationals and people from the Bin Laden family on it, who you're at the same time blaming for the attacks, that's got to be a kind of smoking gun.
Well, of course. I mean, at the time they said that Bin Laden was a renegade, you know, and the Saudis said he's nothing to do with us any longer, you know, we kicked him out into Afghanistan. What's happened since is that the various investigations, and it is a bit different with the paper trail than it is for the towers, where there's just no evidence that's been presented to the public. With the paper trail, it's actually coming out, and if anybody could be bothered to read the full length of the 9/11 Commission report, including the footnotes and the various Inspector General's reports in the departments, you'll find out that the CIA were sheltering the 9/11 hijackers. There's really no other conclusion that can be drawn from the ample evidence from US inquiries. You try telling this to the British media or the American media, they don't want to know. All you're asking them to do is to read a government report. They won't do
it. You know what? To a certain extent, I think it's simply a human reaction. We don't want to admit we got it wrong.
Absolutely.
And also the...
They're very arrogant and conceited people, a lot of journalists.
No offence. There's a lesson to be learned there, I think, for all of us, that, you know, don't stick on a path if it's actually if you've been bamboozled. Hold your hands up and say, I've been bamboozled, and let everybody know about it. But there have been some very good films. I mean, I think maybe before we just mention a few of those, because it's easy to watch these on the internet. If you haven't got the internet, just go around to a friend's house and watch them there. This particular investigation by the Alaskan University is looking at the collapse of the buildings. Now, one of the things, particularly the Twin Towers, obviously Building 7-2, but one of the things that really convinced me that there was something wrong there was hearing the voice recordings of the firefighters who were in the building, both of the Twin Towers, and they were both basically saying, well, effectively, this fire is now out, and yet at that point, the building is supposed to have collapsed.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the cynics would say that that's what triggered the controlled demolition, was when the firemen were finding out there wasn't much wrong. They sort of thought, well, blimey, we'll have to bring this down sooner rather than later, because it happened very soon after that event. And yes, those firefighters, they were also structural experts. One of those two firefighters was a long-time structural expert on the Twin Towers and on terrorism. He was the New York Fire Department terrorism expert. So he wasn't just an ordinary guy who might have got it wrong.
Was he one of the firefighters who was killed as the building?
Oh yeah, he was one of those guys who made that voice recording. Both died in the collapse.
Horrific, absolutely horrific. Martin, one of the things to do with 9/11, I think, which which is almost like a gold seam of an amazing amount of information about why it's such a lie, is this thing Operation Northwoods, which was to do, I believe, with the Cuba and the attempt by the Central Intelligence Agency and the American Pentagon to take over Cuba. What was Operation Northwoods about, and why is it so important?
Well, I mean, this is on the record now. I mean, people just do a search and they'll find out about it. It was in the early 60s when Kennedy was still the president, and the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba had failed, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, led by Lyman Lemnitzer, put together a proposal.
Who, by the way, was attending the Bilderberg conferences at the time in the 1960s?
Well, more than likely. Yeah. more than likely.
Nasty bit of work.
Yeah, they basically put together a plan which has said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to hijack aircraft inside the United States. We're going to crack. We're going to have bomb attacks and so on. We're going to blame the Cubans. We want, and they say we need a long casualty list to get popular anger up, and then we're going to invade Cuba. And the documents which of this proposal were sent to McNamara, who was Kennedy's gatekeeper, and he just said, you people are bonkers, and knocked it on the head. And then subsequently Kennedy, of course, was assassinated. But the fact is, those documents are now in the public domain through Freedom of Information requests in the US, and it's quite clear that the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the US signed this off. That means the top military leadership.
They not only signed it off, but they also didn't seem to be at all worried about whether they could persuade the media to support the story. You know, they barely mention the problems with the media producing, you know, hundreds of people who'd allegedly lost. So, you know, who knows what happened on 9/11?
Amazing.
I'm not even 100%
convinced.
That's right.
So the point is that they were already thinking along those lines in 1964 and were stymied.
Well,
now, in other words, NATO intelligence services and the senior military are simply not to be trusted. They are terrorists. They also bombed Bologna railway station in 1980. In Gladio, etc.
Apart from, I mean, we're also dealing, aren't we, with no, we're talking about Northwoods, but we're also dealing with planes on September the 11th. So, is there any sort of suggestion that perhaps that there was some kind of use of Operation Northwoods and a different version of it was used on 9/11?
My own copper's hunch is that Northwoods was put on the back burner and then constantly updated. And why is it always airports and planes? Well, but who controls the security in airports? Oh, we do. So it's quite simple to set these things up. I mean, if you were really a terrorist and you really wanted to attack, why would you attack an airport which is full of security? You
wouldn't. The other thing to bear in mind is that there was an... The government admits that they had a so-called anti-hijack exercise running at the exact same time that the 9/11 attacks happened, which were allegedly a hijack. So, you know, it makes you wonder if somebody sort of shaded the anti-hijack exercise into the real events.
Well, Naomi Wolf has pointed out that really ever since the September the 11th attacks, we've got to be looking at every single terrorist attack, every single large event, to try and make sense of it as to whether... Basically, the press is bamboozling the public as to what's really gone on, because, I mean, sometimes you can't necessarily blame the press, Martin, can you? Because they're just being fed a load of lies.
They are, but one of the real problems with the press is they can't remember what happened yesterday. There's actually, it's on the record that NATO intelligence services engage in false flag terrorism
just let me
through
one
police investigation
Italy
and Belgium, etc.
One specific example of that, last week when the MP Joe Cox was killed, there was a very similar sort of killing of a Swedish MP in 2003 in the run up to the Swedish referendum. Very similar sort of situation, the far right apparently involved, and yet no mention of that at all about, in the coverage of Joe Cox's
murder. People are given a very superficial understanding of what's going on. They need the historical knowledge of things like Northwoods, of Gladio, which was going on in Western Europe in the 70s and the 80s, virtually all the terrorism in Italy, according to Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, was carried out by NATO intelligence services. That is just a historical fact. It's the sort of thing that there should be a file on four on Radio 4. Panorama programme should have been made about
it.
There was
actually
a BBC.
There was, and the guy died of a heart attack in 1993
that started to expose this. But I'll bet you've got loads of 30-something, 20-something journalists on the national media in Britain who, if you mentioned any of this to them, would go, what? Because they don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a friend who works in the BBC news department, and I better not give you her name, but I promise you she does. And she says, Ian, there's no conspiracy. These guys are just selected because they're not particularly bright. They don't have a terribly good capability of analysing things. They're ex-public school, and, you know, you may as well bang your head against a brick wall as talk to them. That's her line.
That's right. As you say, conceited and arrogant.
Yeah. Very ex-public school as well.
Also, I just wonder what you make of the Orlando killings, Martin. We did talk about this briefly last week, but there's a lot of information, it seems, been coming out about that may not be what it seems at all.
Absolutely. I mean, there's just a plethora of stuff floating around out there. There's one of the most important things that's gone viral is that a guy has handed himself in to a local police force, and he was saying, I was going to carry out an attack on a gay rights parade or something with all this weaponry as part of a false flag attack. And then he realised when Mateen, or Sadiq as his real name is, was killed in the Orlando attack, that he was being set up as a patsy, and he then handed himself into the police. But he's now been taken into the custody of the FBI, and they've knocked the police back. But the police are briefing against the FBI in the United States, and this is running around virally on the internet as we speak.
Amazing, isn't it, that we're living in an age where when we see one of these attacks, the first thing we need to think is anything that I'm being told true or not?
Well, you see, the mainstream has sort of gone halfway to admitting this in a sense. The New York Times has done some very good articles on the way the FBI creates terrorists. They'll find some poor guy who's a bit weak mentally, maybe a bit upset psychologically, maybe smokes a lot of drugs, and they'll persuade them to carry out a terrorist attack or to plan it, and then they'll arrest them, and there'll be a lot of fanfare about how they foiled a terrorist attack. I mean, this sounds unbelievable, doesn't it? But it's all been documented in the New York Times. So maybe what they do, you know, maybe one of these gets out of hand and the guy thinks, I'll create a terrorist attack, and just goes off and does it, because arms are quite available in America, you know. So it could be that this Orlando killer, that the whole story is true, except that he was incited and edged into it by FBI officers.
Well, that certainly
there are suggestions
happened.
Also that there were multiple shooters. That guy supposedly posting on Facebook, sending messages to local radio stations. Meanwhile, with a non-fully automatic weapon, he's killed 50 people with 100 and something shots. Doesn't add up.
Going back to the Joe Cox killing last week, one of the most shocking videos I saw was one of the eyewitnesses to the attack saying definitely nobody shouted, put Britain first. There was
But I would make the point that when he was taken to court and asked his name, he said death to traitors, freedom for Britain or something. So in other words, it does indeed seem to have some political motivation. But of course, the real question, just like Breivik at Utøya, is who's pulling his strings? Is it possible that these people can be tasted up to do this? That's what's been going on in the past. In Italy in the 70s, both left and right-wing terrorism were being orchestrated
by the
intelligence services.
You've hit the nail on the head there, because I think one of the most fascinating articles of the week, of course, not published in any of the London media, was Craig Murray's report saying only Muslims are terrorists. It's now official.
Yeah.
Effectively looking at the attack on Joe Cox and saying, well, why is this guy not a terrorist? It does seem as if there's an absolutely enormous amount of...
Well, they changed from being a mass shooter. That the guy in Orlando, he started off as a mass shooter, and once they managed to hang the sort of Islamic sort of label on him, he turned into a terrorist, I believe. Is that right,
there's more stuff around. It's very complex. There's a load of stuff coming.
What Craig Murray's saying here is, let me avoid hypocrisy. I rather like this little bit he's written here. I do not think Thomas Mayer should be charged with terrorism, because I do not think anybody should be charged with terrorism. I have held that the law making orgy of new terrorist offences was legally unnecessary and purely political propaganda. Murder and conspiracy to murder always were perfectly adequate offences, and that is what terrorists ought to be charged with. Murder is the same sordid murder, whatever the motive, and to have a terrorist murder as a separate offence imbues it with a nobility it does not deserve.
Yeah, and of course they're doing the same thing about, they're trying to suggest that there aren't laws against incitement. You know, when one of these things come up, there's always somebody saying, well, we must control the media more, we must control what people say more, you know, we must throw people in jail for what they say in the pub. Well, there is incitement. We can already do that. If somebody's inciting murder, there's plenty of, you don't need a new law to do that. The reason they need the new laws is because they want to create them so broadly worded that you can then be charged for incitement for not inciting things, just doing things that might incite something.
He says, Thomas Mayer is not an isolated case. Ryan McGee, who built a nail bomb to attack Muslims, and Pavlo Lapshin, who murdered a Muslim and bombed mosques, were not charged with terrorism either. Mayer, McGee and Lapshin would all, beyond any possible shadow of a doubt, be charged with terrorism if they were Muslims, Martin.
Obviously, this is the case. So, and of course, what happened at Utøya, Breivik was regarded as a loner, etc., etc. But in actual fact, again, there's got to be a question about how does he kill 70 people?
He certainly wasn't a loner in his Freemason lodges, was he? He was very close to other people from the far right, apparently Knights Templar, and the boss of the EDL. He was quite pally with him on Facebook, and he came to Britain to meet him.
The pattern of these terrorist attacks if we think about Italy, Belgium in the 70s and the 80s, is that they are basically orchestrated from within the state, but made to look as if they are extremists of left and right, so that the state can absorb more power to itself to do what it wants to do.
And the security services.
And the security services.
I mean, one thing that, I'm not sure how much you've covered this, but my partner's German, and so I follow events in Germany. The German equivalent of MI5 have been caught not so much infiltrating as actually creating far right parties. You know, the regional organizer.
Is this the fashion shirts we were hearing about last week?
There's two different groups, Bundesnachrichtendienst and Verfassungsschutz. I think it was actually the BND who were caught, and they more or less set
clever,
up a right wing party. You know, they actually
way this is spun is, of course, we're trying to infiltrate these groups.
Yeah. But there's a thin line
between infiltration and direction.
Well,
that's the group's concern.
I think what Ian's saying is the Germans have definitely crossed that thin line. Also, before we finish this discussion, let's also look at the Chilcot report, which apparently is going to come out now after the referendum. And another great post by Craig Murray, my favourite blogger, I suppose I have to say, is Peter Oborne. Is everything Chilcot would not be? Concise, honed, forensic and devastatingly logical. Oborne's Not the Chilcot Report is the most important book that will be published this year. I strongly urge you to read it. Anyone who doubts the continued relevance of what Tony Blair did then to Britain today will be left in no doubt of the poison still pumping around not just the British political system but the entire Middle East. So I want finally both of your comments on why Blair has still not been arrested, Martin.
Well, because he's being protected, quite simply. I think ultimately he is a low-level operative in the evil networks we're talking about. There are people behind him who are more important.
Well, I think it's an establishment club. You know, it's one law for the rich and another for the poor. One law for politicians who are inciting and carrying out murder, and another law, and it is murder. You know, when you invade a foreign country with no UN approval, in fact in defiance of the United Nations Charter, that is murder. So, you know, I'm not exaggerating there. There's one law for murder if you're a politician, one law for murder if you're not a politician, and then another one if you're a Muslim.
Well, you're very disappointed to see the United Nations has now had its Judicial Committee, the chair replaced by an Israeli, and the Human Rights Committee, the chair has just recently, a couple of months ago, been replaced by a Saudi Arabian nomination. So it looks like the Israeli government are taking over effectively control of the Judicial Committee at the UN, and the Saudis taking over the human rights. I mean,
somebody's trying to wreck the UN, aren't they? That's the conclusion. You know, you've got to be taking the mickey, haven't you, if to be doing that.
Anyway, just to finish on a sort of, I suppose, on the 9/11 story on a bit of a more positive note, here's some music, and actually some songs being written about this kind of thing.
For hours. fall. Pretty much dead on the acceleration of gravity.
Building right there, the brown building, the tall one, is number 7 World Trade Center. Heard several reports from several different officers now that that is the building that is going to go down next. In fact, one officer told me they're just waiting for that to come down at this point.
When I fell down, fell into my footprint, the other building barely had a scratch, and in a few weeks they got rid of all my wreckage so that no one could investigate my fall.
Almost as if it were a planned implosion. It just pancaked.
And I turned in time to see what looked like a skyscraper implosion. Looked like it had been done by a demolition crew. The whole thing just collapsing down on itself.
For the third time today, reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
Can you confirm it was number 7 that just went in?
Yes, sir.
And you guys knew this was coming all day.
We had heard reports that the building was unstable and that it eventually would either come down on its own or it would be taken down.
Well, that's part of a competition which was run by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth to do a song about the free fall collapse of Building 7 at World Trade Center on September the 11th. Now, what about the Russians? What is their view of the Bilderberg conferences? And is Vladimir Putin just another gangster?
My name is Gennady, and I am from the former Soviet Union, of course, yeah, but I already have been living in the West for the last 26 years. So I used to work before in the aerospace industry, in the former Soviet Union aerospace industry, and I used to work in the aerospace industry in Germany for Airbus, not directly, but for some suppliers of Airbus. And I used to work for some American sort of government organization as a contractor. And I know, I gathered a lot of experience in military, political issues in aerospace, and I sort of like, of course, I always observed what is going on in the former Soviet Union during the Yeltsin chaotic times, and I can tell you for sure that Putin is not gangster at all. I mean, just really. And
he does seem to just be prepared to do deals, to sell various things for getting a good relationship with the big guys, the Americans.
But he has no choice, because Russia still now is technologically disadvantaged, and they need some time to get some grasp of the technology, even, because they really backward in many areas. Look at the last example, this MS-21 aircraft. Yeah, it was like a aircraft similar to Boeing 737 on Boeing's Airbus 320, and only 50% of the technology is genuine Russian technology. The rest, basically all systems are Western systems. So, I mean, they still need something to do. They need time. Well, what they can only do, they can do some good military stuff, and to protect themselves, but they still need a lot of technologies and a lot of advances. Maybe they need even to change the mind of the Russian people, because many Russian people still sort of like not accustomed for the real competition.
But I mean, Putin, he's having to deal with the very, very powerful oligarchs in Russia still, isn't he? He can't really do what he wants.
Yeah, of course. That's why he's trying to maneuver himself. I mean, and his only guys, former KGB guys. So basically, this his narrow circle of friends. Though only with those friends he can survive, because the sort of sharks Jewish oligarchs, or other sharks, Russian, sort of Russian oligarchs, what they call themselves Russian, but in fact they're Jewish, and he only can position himself in support by the support of this former KGB guys. And there is nothing here, I mean, to blame. I would not blame him for this. He's still trying to survive. He's still doing pretty well in comparison to what could have happened. I mean, if he would be given at least 10 years, we will see absolutely another Russia and maybe another absolutely another world. Because in order to protect common people in the West, they probably should support Putin now.
How do you see the Bilderberg, and how are they viewed, do you think, by Russians?
Listen, I do not live exactly in Russia. I cannot tell you on behalf of the Russian people, yeah, but I can tell from my own kind of experience and my own view. Yeah, those guys just need to, they kind of like private guys coming here, meeting with some sort of government guys, and they're instructing them what they should expect, what they should do. But they're trying to sort of to explore situation, what is going on now, and keep your finger on the pulse, so to say. But it's not real. There is no real secrecy here. I mean, this just sort of like instruction for the some kind of prime ministers or some economy ministers, this sort of hidden sort of instructions.
Have you worked on both sides of the old Cold War divide in Russia and in the West, in your former Soviet Union? What do you think is the professionalism on both sides of the military?
I see American guys very professional, yeah, but in terms of Russian guys, they're really tough guys. I mean, they may be missing some stuff, but they're learning very fast. So, I mean, you cannot. In some way they may be not really sort of well advanced as American military. Yeah, but if you compare them in they in the real fight, I would bet that Russia will win.
So you think maybe that the West wouldn't dare to take on the Russians in places like Syria and Ukraine militarily? What do you make of those two issues? Because there's a lot of tension
absolutely.
Around
I mean, absolutely they would not take on Russia in Ukraine or in Syria. That's why they're using Ukrainian idiots. They're using Ukrainian idiots in order to take on Russians. I mean, this is clear, and Putin reacted very, very smartly. He also used the Ukrainians from the Russian side, from the eastern Ukraine. So basically, it's just, this is a game, but Americans are afraid to take on Russians directly.
What about Syria? What do you make of that? Because that's always been a potential hotspot in the Cold War, even.
Yeah, but I would involve in Israel there, because I assume that all problems go from Israel there. I mean, in Syria, they still want Syria to destroy Syria, to make maybe 3-5 states, small states, and manipulate Syria. That's why basically Israel is behind all the problems there.
A lot of Russians point the finger at the United States. They say this is a real bogeyman. And Israel too, you've just mentioned there. Both of those countries were actually originally created by the British.
No. In some way, yes. But what I'm trying to say now, that Israel is basically using the U.S. as a proxy. And Israel is behind all problems here. So I'm just... All in the world, and even the Bilderberg, they kind of Israel, there is no Israeli guys there directly. But there are some Jewish guys who represent Israel. I mean, come on.
Do you see any solutions to these tensions around the world, financial war between the superpowers?
No. As I see right now, the only counterbalance to the Bilderberg is Russia. I mean, really Putin. So, I mean, the only chance for the rest of the world, just support Putin. It's a counterbalance. I mean, if you be talking about check and balances, system of checks and balances, yeah? This exactly, if you're talking about the system of checks and balances, the counterbalance here for the Bilderberg would be the Russia. I mean, truly. This is my point.
That's Gennady there. He used to work for Antonov, aerospace engineer, the Antonov design house over in the former Soviet Union, and now working apparently with Airbus and big Western companies, but he only wanted to give me his first name. Also, when I was over in Dresden at the Bilderberg meeting last week, it was just about last week, week before last really, I also spoke to Marco and Maria. They're from We Are Change Rotterdam, and amongst examining the Bilderbergs, they've also been taking a very good look at this former Chief Justice over in Holland. His name is something Joris, I think his second name Wim, what's his name, Joris Demmink too. So here's my interview with them now.
My name is Marco, Marco Verhey. I'm from We Are Change Rotterdam, and this is our third Bilderberg we report on. We Are Change is citizen journalism, so we ask questions and we demand answers. We have a broad themes that we cover, so sometimes there's people that follow us because of we do unemployment as well in Holland, or we do the Bilderberg, and there's different subjects, so people coming through those subjects.
Well, I'm Maria, and together with Marco, we are started We Are Change Rotterdam, and we want to cover this because our mainstream media doesn't give a damn about it, or is refusing to share photos, information about this very secretive meeting.
So, okay, so why is the mainstream media ignoring it almost? I mean, usually there are maybe a few reports, but there's no proper analysis. Why is that?
I think because they're part of this, they are in it. So if you see who is there in the last, who visited Bilderberg from the Dutch mainstream media in the last couple of years, that's quite interesting. We have this guy, it's called Ben Knape. He was first head editor of the NRC, that is the main newspaper, intellectual newspaper in the Netherlands. After he visited Bilderberg, he went into politics and became a member of parliament. So I think that they're very they're into this kind of secretive meetings, and that's the main reason that they're not reporting about it. And most of the time, when they put it in a newspaper, a very small column about it, it's all about conspiracy. So that's the main frame that mainstream media uses to cover everything up.
The thing is, it is a conspiracy, isn't it? There are financial criminals and war criminals inside.
Yeah, but it's a very important lobby group. It's a very important network. So I think the whole point about conspiracy, or rather, I prefer not to use that word anymore because it's so tainted. Yeah.
Tell me about some of the other participants from Holland who come to these meetings, and maybe one who's inside today.
Okay, well, I can name them all who are inside here from Holland. That's Mr. Van Beurden. He's the Shell manager, the big boss of Shell. Then there's our king, Alexander. He's here for the first time to take over from his mum, Beatrix. It's his sixth time for Alexander, and for Van Beurden, it's his, I think, his fourth time. Then there's our prime minister, Rutte. It's his fourth time as well. And then there's two debutants who are the mayor of Rotterdam, Ahmed Abu Talib, and there's Sharon Dijksma. She's a Labour Secretary of State.
The third person that is having her debut here is Kasia Ollengren, and she is
Deputy Mayor of Amsterdam. And she's from another democratic political party.
So what's the role of Bilderberg?
The role? I think it's a well-organized business network. And I think that the persons that are inside are wheeling and dealing with each other to make sure that they benefit. So it's to their best advantage that they're here. And I think it's a great career booster. And especially when we look at Abu Talib, one of our mayor of Rotterdam, the first Islam mayor in Holland. We see that his star is rising since the moment that he spoke very firmly about jihadist people that are want to go to Syria to fight. So he said, let's get out, rot op. That is what he say in Dutch, rot op. And afterwards he was invited in the White House. There he put his signature also in Arabic. And now we see this guy here in Bilderberg, and we met him for several times. He refuses us every time to talk with us. And when we asked the spokesman of Abu Talib just before he went to Bilderberg, and Marco went to him, and he said, well, oh, you guys, you're just conspiracy guys. So that says it all. He's pitched Abu Talib to get a sort of new head of the leading Labour Party in the Netherlands. And now he's here. What a surprise.
I think that this is also a big career move, or a career opportunity for people to show themselves in front of the elite of the world. They can really show that they are ready to join the big club. And once they've joined the big club, then doors open that before that were closed. We can see that in the career moves that some of the politicians made. You can see career moves going from politics to the bank or to a multinational or the other way around. Yeah, so I think it's a big career opportunity for people who are here.
Bilderberg is a Dutch word. Is it very well understood, this organization in Holland?
You can say it's a German word, a Bilderberg. So it's like a picture mountain. Yeah, Bilderberg. In Dutch, it's just a name. And it's the name of a well-known, also really good hotel chain. Yeah. So there's also a Bilderberg Hotel in Rotterdam, for instance. The Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek, which is near Arnhem, was where the first Bilderberg was held in 1954. So that's the link with the name with Holland, and also, of course, with Prince Bernard.
Is it well understood, this organization in Holland?
No, I think it's not well understood. The way that this is framed in the media, I think the way that Bilderberg was presented by the alternative media, say, 10, 15 years ago, was, oh, you should be ashamed of yourself if you're in here. Yeah? If you're at Bilderberg, ooh, you should be ashamed of yourself. Now I think the way that Bilderberg wants to be presented, so they want the media to cover it in a way that this is something to aspire for. Yeah, this is something where, wow, this is where you want to be, at Bilderberg. This is the top of the top. Yeah.
And what about the politicians and the media that are in here?
The politicians, I think, it's quite clear because they are supposed to lead the country. When we look at the journalists, I think that they want to present certain frames to the world. So they want the mainstream media to write the story in a way so that people will all think the same way. For instance, about Russia. Yeah, so we need to be angry with Russia. Putin is not a good guy. He's wrong. Yeah, he's evil. I think that there's a role there for that.
But you had an aircraft, didn't you? A Malaysian aircraft that flew from Amsterdam and was shot down over Ukraine, apparently by the separatists there. I mean, are you not angry with Russia?
Not me personally. When I hear this, I think of Mr. Rutte, who is inside here, who said that the bottom stone, that is the one that we will find and we will get this up. This means that we will get everything out in the open, we will find who did this, and we will get all the facts open for the Dutch people to look at, or for the families of the people who died there. Yeah, that's what he promised to the people who are left behind. Yeah, he never did that. They presented lies in an official government document.
I noticed that there's actually a very good Dutch website that's looking into that. And also, I'm afraid to say, as a British person, the British have still got the black box from that aircraft, apparently, and they haven't released the information to the public and to the victims' families. It's been quite big, that Malaysian airliner that flew from, I think it was going from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, I think, and then it came down. Do you think that the Dutch people are convinced, ordinary Dutch people, that was a justification for the sanctions or not?
I don't think that they bring the two together, the sanctions and the aircraft being shot down. I think that they're angry with the government for not presenting them the truth. I don't know if I'm talking about a majority, but there's a lot of people that don't trust the government on MH17. Then on the other hand, the sanctions or the way that Russia is being viewed, I don't think there's a lot of people that put these two together. So about MH17, the Dutch government brought out this report in which whole pages were painted black, yeah, so they were censored, so that people could not find out what was said there. So many people just don't trust the government on this matter. On the other hand, there was this initiative from a media group who wanted a referendum on the joining of Ukraine with the EU. And a majority of the Dutch said they didn't want the Ukraine to enter the EU. They sort of stopped it, but on the other hand, the government is now looking for a way around to implement it still.
Concerning the referendum, it was a trade agreement that was already signed off in the European Commission. And people were so fed up with the whole situation about MH17 that they want to have a referendum to make sure, to make their mark, that they were so fed up with it. And that was an effect on this trade agreement. They did it, so they had enough signatures to make that happen. But still, our government have to think about if they want to go through with this. So this is all... Well, and especially about the politicians that are here, and that is my main concern, also I want to emphasize their role. It's a complete lack of democratic influence that we are experiencing. In there are politicians. Their job is representing the people. But in return, we get fences. We get no information. We get Chatham House rule. So how can they do their job as representatives of us if we are not aware of the information that they're sharing, the talks? For an example, Willem-Alexander, the whole House of Orange, our monarchs, have an enormous amount of shares in Shell. So, you know, it's a very thin line between the politicians, the monarchy here, and the mainstream media. And the fences around here, it really illustrates that democracy is nothing worth for them.
You do most of your work in Dutch, I imagine. Do you all in Dutch, pretty much? But there may be some Dutch people listening. Where can we find you online?
You can find us at wearechange.nl, which is our website. And then we are, of course, on YouTube. There's the whole archive of more than 300 publications we did in the last 4 years. And we can be found on Facebook.
We have also a playlist with subtitled and English spoken vids. So there you can find confrontations with a lot of Dutch Bilderbergers that we spoke. Sometimes they even really want to talk with us about that.
In Holland, we had the Secretary General, which is the highest position on the Ministry of Justice, is a pedophile. He's now retired, but for years he held this position. Now there are some people saying, oh, we want this guy in court. Yeah, so they're trying to get him there. A few weeks ago he was there, but he was a witness. But still he was asked many questions that he didn't like, obviously. And when he came out of the courtroom, my colleague here was waiting for him to ask him some tough questions.
These are a couple of topics that drives us to explore the borders of democracy and also to unveil this kind of power mechanisms.
We have a lot of interviews in English as well. I mean, there's people that visit Holland where we go like, oh, we want to speak to that person. So there's a lot of interviews we have. We have an interview with Max Egan, Max Kaiser, about the Zionism. Norman Finkelstein, for instance, yeah.
That's Marco and Marie there from We Are Change Rotterdam, and the politicians they're referring to, is Joris Demmink, the Dutch politician. So, finally, spoke to a chap called Volker Reusing. He's from Unze Politics blog, about what happens when private banks want to foreclose on governments.
I'm Volker Reusing. I'm from Unser Politik blog. It's a non-profit internet blog. We're making interviews and articles on Unser Politik blog. We're from Germany. State insolvency procedure, they have hidden it in Article 12, Paragraph 3, ESM Treaty. It's only included that all countries which have the currency euro have to attach to their state debts collective action clauses. And they have not published what is in there. Collective action clauses, but for the ESM, several laws in Germany have been changed. Also, the law in Germany on the public debt management, in German Bundesschuldenwesengesetz. And into the law on the public debt management, the Bundesschuldenwesengesetz, they have inserted the articles 4a to 4k. And if you read those articles, then you see there's a certain date. And the debts have to be told to a court in Frankfurt. Private creditors have to tell to this court the debts of Germany or the demands they have to Germany at this certain date. And it's like a private insolvency procedure, and then you have assembly of the private creditors, yeah. And they can make decisions to change the collective action clauses, so they can say, okay, we reduce the interest rate on the debts, or we reduce the nominal value of the debts, but they will want something in exchange. That will be privatization. Where do I know it from? Several persons have said that they want the ESM to speed up privatization, to find it, for example, den Artikel, I think it has been from July or August, of the Deutsche Wirtschaftsnachrichten, where Markus Kerber, who is General Secretary of the big industrial NGO, BDI, Bund Deutscher Industrie, talked about the ESM and that it should be used to speed up privatization and that the states should give their property as a security for the event that they go bankrupt.
Many people would say that Greece is insolvent now.
Yeah, the normal thing to do if a state is insolvent is, then is not to make a state insolvency procedure, but that the state is obliged to talk with all its creditors, and then if they don't come to an appointment, then the state has to decide itself, because the state is sovereign. And the standard according to which any state bankruptcy has to be made, the standard are the human rights which are applicable in that state, of the human rights treaties a state has ratified, and particularly in the national constitution of the respective state. For example, where they wanted to make a global ESM, the debt crisis of Argentina has been the pretext, and where they wanted to fool the people, the countries of the G77, and they have asked for the UN to make a global state insolvency procedure. But then they have been informed what is going on in Europe and how the people in Europe have been fooled, and that is for total privatization. And then they have concluded something else. At September the 10th of 2015, the states, 136 states, don't want a global ESM, but they have said, okay, if the state and its creditors do not find a compromise, then the state has to decide itself. And they have concluded 8 standards on which to do that. And one standard, at least, is to respect human rights. It means to make the human rights situation not worse than it is before the state bankrupt. That's very protective for the poor and inhabitants and people who need health services. And
if this privatization goes forward, it looks like it may well go forward, who will end up owning what is now our national governments?
Well, the national governments will remain where they are. Also, the parliaments will remain where they are. And the public tasks will remain where they are. But all other tasks will be done by private firms. And they have not done it very far because of the Constitutional Court decision, of the German Constitutional Court decision from June the 30th of 2009, the Lisbon judgment. The Lisbon judgment has said, okay, you can enact the Lisbon Treaty, but only with, they have made a long list of provisions where the limits are of its implementation. And they have prohibited the privatization of police, of military, and also of any civil services which are sovereign. They have prohibited all this privatization of the sovereign tasks, but it's binding only for Germany.
That was Volker Reusing from Unser Politics blog, and you can hear the remainder of that, the full interview on Dialect, that's next Tuesday at noon. Also, some stuff from Bristol CND and a fascinating interview about the former Yugoslavia. This is Tony Gosling signing off for the evening. Thanks very much for listening. Join us again. We're online at thisweek.org.uk with all the links to this show. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. And as ever, don't let those banksters get you down.
Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.